For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we're having a listen to the audio version of the brand new book, Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out, and we'll have a chat with the author, Ryan Love. All that and more on today's Read On. A quick trigger warning, this interview does mention a suicide attempt. New novel, Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out by Ryan Love. In fact, it's so new, if you're listening to this on the day of release, it came out yesterday. Has been described as the uplifting feel-good read of 2023. Perfect for fans of Mike Gale, Beth O'Leary and Alice Osman's Heartstopper. When 79-year-old Arthur Edwards gathers his family together to share some important news, no one is prepared for the bombshell he drops. He's gay. And after a lifetime in the closet, he's finally ready to come out. Arthur's 21-year-old grandson Teddy has a secret of his own. He's also gay and developing serious feelings for his colleague Ben. But Teddy doesn't feel ready to come out yet, especially when Arthur's announcement causes shockwaves in the family. Author Ryan Love will join me in a moment to tell us about Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out, but first, let's hear a clip of the audio version. Teddy is played by Caius Nicholas, but the first voice you'll hear is Arthur's, as read by Bruce Alexander.
I know you pair, there's something. I've seen those glances at each other.
You're right, Arthur said, prompting all three heads to turn in his direction. There's a reason we asked you to come here tonight.
Madeline reached across and held her hand out. Arthur took it, and their fingers knitted together. He squeezed it tightly. Is something wrong? Elizabeth said. The mood in the room had shifted. Arthur hated hearing the sudden sense of panic in his daughter's voice. He felt Madeline's wedding ring press into his finger as she gripped his hand even tighter.
Is Davina McCall about to arrive with our long-lost brother?
Shut up, Patrick! Elizabeth hissed. Daddy, please, what's going on? Arthur took a deep breath.
Your mother and I will always love each other very much. But we are not together any more, and it's not because we don't still love each other very much.
Arthur paused. His next few words would change everything. There was no stopping now as his two children stared back at him, their eyes wide with anticipation. He closed his eyes and allowed the words to finally leave his mouth.
The truth is, I'm gay.
Teddy. Edward Marsh? Hi, just Teddy is fine. He lurched forward awkwardly to shake the man's hand. Thanks for this opportunity, Mr. Stone. It's great to be here.
Not at all. We're delighted to have you join us. When Elizabeth Marsh says her son wants to be a journalist, well, she's a persuasive woman, your mother.
There it was. Teddy knew it wouldn't take long. It would be the first of many mentions of his mum, Elizabeth Marsh, their cherished, award-winning columnist. It would no doubt be common knowledge already that she had a private word and secured her only son a trainee reporter role. He was genuinely grateful for the chance to prove himself, even if it meant accepting that he needed a helping hand. That hadn't been easy to stomach, but he knew he had no other choice. He needed to get his life back on track.
Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out is essentially the story of a grandfather and a grandson who both are at very different stages of their lives, but have been hiding this thing and are very much ready to come out as gay and live their best lives.
Now, you're much closer in age to Teddy as you are Arthur. Is Teddy's experience based on your own?
I mean, it was very slightly. It was something that I was keen to avoid, was trying to put too much of myself into Teddy. So Teddy's 21 and I tried to sort of go back to where I was at that age. So it was around that time that I did come out. So that was definitely important when I was sort of trying to shape the experience for him. But we're very different as people. I mean, it was definitely easier to sort of channel that and to sort of take myself back to that point and the sort of stress that it caused me as a person and how I think I wanted things to go and just how he's viewing the world at that age.
You say that the book's a bit of a warm hug. Was that the hug you needed at that age?
I think, yeah, it definitely was. And I was exceptionally lucky. I had the most wonderful family. Both my parents, when I came out, were incredibly supportive. My entire family was. So I had no real hardship. So I was very privileged in that respect. I think leading up to it, it was the hug I needed. I needed that encouragement to sort of go, everything's going to be just fine. And a lot of people aren't that lucky. And of course, you want people to know that there is hope still, you know, and not to be terrified of it. Because, you know, I very much projected a lot of my fears onto my family and sort of thinking, you know, the worst that could happen. And that was a real regret of mine after coming out, was that I had created this scenario in my head where my parents would react totally differently to how they were. And I think that is definitely one of my regrets, because I feel like I did them such a disservice as people, because I should really have known, but it was just the total fear that led me to building up this picture of what could be. So yeah, it definitely, I think if I was 20, 21 again, I would like to read something like that, that sort of did give me that hug.
The room was silent. It was as if nobody dared breathe in the seconds which followed. It was done. He'd said the words out loud. There was no taking them back now. He looked intently at his two children. Patrick stood up, shaking his head slowly. Is there a punchline to this? I don't get it. It's true. Please, can you sit, Patrick? Madeline was soft-spoken, but they knew when she was serious. Anyone who had ever worked for her knew when Madeline was not to be argued with. As she had requested, Patrick sat back down. Neither he nor Elizabeth looked in Arthur's direction, instead directing their attention to Madeline. You knew about this? Elizabeth said. I've known for a while, yes. That is not what is important here, though. This is about your father telling you something very personal. I think we have a right to know what the hell is going on and why you're tolerating this. No, Elizabeth, you don't. All you need to know is that I'm here beside your father and asking you to listen to and love him, because he is still the same man. He's still your dad. Elizabeth put her head in her hands. I cannot believe what I'm hearing. You've been married 50 years and you're sitting there like he's just told you that he forgot to buy milk.
Did you kind of project those fears onto the character of Elizabeth? Did she react the way you thought people might react?
Very much so. And Elizabeth is Teddy's mum and Arthur's daughter. So I wanted someone who represented all those fears that we do have when we're at that stage of, you know, the pro of coming out. And Elizabeth, for me, she's a funny character, because I know people will see her as being homophobic and having all those issues. But for me, when I was writing her, I was really trying to channel someone who was confused but also hurt by not understanding her father and not understanding how he'd lived this life. And was really projecting then, perhaps, yes, what I expected perhaps people to react like. But a lot of Elizabeth's angst and sort of issues come from the lies rather than being outright homophobic. And it just sort of comes out the wrong way a lot of the time when she's talking and her behavior. But a lot of it is just the hurt of not understanding and then feeling like she wasn't the mum that Teddy needed and how she reacts to that situation.
Is Arthur based on anyone, or is he just like the ideal grandparent?
Yeah, Arthur was kind of like that for me. So my mum's parents died when she was 16. And I've grown up hearing all these incredible stories about them and always wishing that I knew them. And then my dad's dad died when I was 3. So I never had a grandfather figure in my life. And I was always incredibly, incredibly jealous of people who had grandparents growing up and, you know, just had that relationship with older people, because I just loved that. So, you know, I had my like great aunts about and great uncles, but I never had that grandparent relationship. And then it was during COVID, and there was obviously a lot of stories about people being separated from their grandparents and, you know, stuff like that. And I was so moved by so much of that. And then I was just dreaming of what it would be like to have, you know, have them again, and what they would make of life today and the whole situation we were in at that time. And then I got into conversations with mom about what her dad might think of, you know, me being gay or me doing what I was doing. And yeah, it kind of all just led from there, where I was like, gosh, what would this man think? And then Arthur was kind of born out of that. And then as I was reading online and just sort of looking around at different stories around that time, I saw a man in America who, during lockdown, actually came out when he was 90. And it was just so inspiring. And the two stories kind of just merged, where I was able to create this grandfather character who I had always sort of wanted, who I could turn to, who is just this figure in your life who you trust and love so much, and who's just always there for you, but is going through his own thing as well, and can sort of channel his life and, you know, give you his experiences, but knows exactly what you're going through.
I don't know what the law was in America, but certainly in the UK, homosexuality was illegal, doing some rough maths,
yeah,
until Arthur was about his mid-20s. Do you think he had a choice about coming out the closet?
No, realistically, he didn't, which, you know, in my head, I think the character of Arthur definitely knew that. And without going into, you know, spoiler territory, he had this relationship and very much experienced this love for the first time, and created this ideal image in his head that he had found this person and could have this thing. And he knew it wasn't going to last, and sort of rebelled against that, you know. And I think ultimately he then knew it wasn't going to work, and found this workable arrangement with Madeline, who was also in a situation she didn't want to be in. And the two characters knew they were in this situation that they didn't like, but had to make it work for themselves. And together, you know, if they have this sort of what starts as a marriage of convenience, where they're both saving each other from two very unknown futures in this small town. But then it grows into this love that they have for 50 years, and they have a family, and they make it work. But Madeline always knew who Arthur really was. And likewise, it sort of just worked for both of them, until now, when Arthur's very much at this age where he's really ready to sort of say, I need to do this. I'm at this stage of life, and I need to take this chance.
Do you think for people of that generation, that's a story that happened far more often than we may realise?
Absolutely. And I think it's so important. You know, I don't know anyone personally who went through that or lived that life. I mean, I would absolutely love to hear from them themselves, because I think there's so many of them stories, and it's so important that we don't forget that it's not that long ago that people were really forced into situations like that, and to hiding who they really were, and, you know, living those lives.
During the book, you tell the story from Teddy's point of view and Arthur's point of view, chapter by chapter. Was one character easier than the other?
You know, you might think that Teddy should have been slightly easier as we are closer in age, but I think I really just found something so enjoyable about Arthur's story that I was really just loving putting myself into that mindset, and, you know, really just telling the story from his view in his chapters. There was just something so, I think it was the escapism for me. I was able to really just leave this younger character and this modern world that I feel like, I sort of know, and go back into Arthur's head, which was so different. And his viewpoints, you know, his view of the world he's living in and the experiences he's having with the people around him is so different that I really loved doing that. Whether it was easier, perhaps more enjoyable, definitely not easier, because you don't want to, you know, take for granted that you are writing, you know, a 79-year-old who turns 80 and trying to sort of get that right. But yeah, I really loved writing Arthur so much. I think there's something about the older characters that I absolutely adore. So telling their story and finding their sort of personality is something that was more of a challenge, but a really, really enjoyable one.
As I said, the book's told by two different voices. Therefore, the audiobook has two different voices, Bruce Alexander and Caius Nicholas. What did you think of the audio version?
Honestly, I was just blown away. It was an experience I didn't really know much about. So I was really lucky. The senior audio editor at HarperCollins, Rebecca, who I worked with, she sent me some incredible samples. And as soon as I actually listened to them with my mum, and we just listened to these samples and knew straight away that they had found the two most perfect voices.
Can you say something? Why are you just sitting there mute as per usual? Talk some sense into her, Elizabeth shouted at her brother. What am I supposed to do? We can't force Mum to do anything she doesn't want to do. Arthur could see his daughter was growing more and more frustrated. Her neck and the top of her chest was breaking out in a blotchy red rash. Lizzie, please, let me explain, he said, reaching out his right hand to touch her. Don't you dare Lizzie me! Don't even touch me! I can't believe this! Everything is just one big lie!
Teddy, Shaquille and Lexi found themselves in a cute little pub near the office called the Mayflower. Once they had drinks, Teddy brought them up to speed on his first day. By the time he was finished, Lexi was smirking at him.
Come on, Teddy. I've only known you a few years, and even I know this is classic you, she said. What's that supposed to mean? You assume someone is going to judge you for who you are, and you make them the enemy before they even have a chance to show you who they are. You did the same thing when you met me, even though I'd no idea who your mother was. Not this time. This guy is so full of himself, making little remarks. You should have heard him. It's not my fault they forgot to tell Dylan he was coming, is it?
Bruce Alexander, who people might know from A Touch of Frost, has the most engaging, warm voice, and it was just everything that I kind of imagined Arthur to be. Yeah, as soon as I heard it, it was just like, wow, this is exactly the man that I expect to hear when I'm here reading or writing, you know, his dialogue. So the whole experience was incredible. I was lucky enough to be able to go to the studio and to sit in on the few days they recorded and to see them at work. There's so much more that goes into it, and I didn't have a full appreciation for the preparation and the work that the actors do when they're, you know, taking on roles like this, because obviously they read individual chapters, or the characters' chapters each, but they're doing voices characters for everyone, and it was so impressive to see the care that they took with each one and how they built the characters from the source material itself. Yeah, so I was completely blown away, and it gave me such a new appreciation for audiobooks itself and the work that goes into them.
I've heard that it can be quite a surreal experience hearing your words coming from someone else.
It was completely surreal, and there was a few times I was sort of sinking back in the chair, just completely flabbergasted to be in this situation, to have the chance, because this is my first book, so to have that experience and to sit there and hear people actually reading your words out loud was incredible, and yeah, really, really bonkers.
Now, if you ever write a book set in Ireland, around Ireland, do you think you'd fancy narrating it yourself?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if people would like to listen to me talking for that long. I mean, you know, it's quite a long process, so I'm not sure I would be cut out for the full, perhaps, 9-hour day of sitting reading my own words.
Is that part of the writing process? Do you read it to yourself, maybe out loud or maybe internally, especially when you're writing dialogue? Is that part of your process?
Do you know, it was at the start, and then I quickly sort of stopped, because during the process I was so keen to try and get the words down, especially on a first draft, which was a real part of the learning process. Yeah, so at the start I was very much stopping and starting and reading back, sort of being overly critical of myself and sort of going, oh, I don't like this, and then stopping again. So I very quickly stopped and was just in the mind frame of write it down, keep going, and don't read it back. On perhaps the second and third draft, I was definitely reading it out to myself a bit more to try and make sure that I was, you know, getting perhaps some structure or stuff like that right. But no, on the whole, it was very much just right, and try not to focus on spending too much time reading it out loud.
Now, one thing we don't get when we download the audiobook from the RNIB library is the cover of the book. Can you describe it for us?
Yes, of course. So the cover, the designer, Charlotte Phillips, sort of gave us the front cover is basically like a closet. So in the background of the closet, you have this rainbow range of clothes, which I thought was a lovely touch, hanging on a rail. You've got the light bulb coming down, so you very much know it's representing a closet. And then you've got Arthur and Teddy both in the forefront. They're right there, sort of beside each other. It's a very bright and engaging. You know, Arthur's got a lovely sort of pinky shirt on with his bow tie. I think they just both look very friendly and warm. So you get a real sense of what you're picking up with the book. It just looks like the sort of hug that I hope people think it is. You know, it just looks engaging and friendly. Their faces, they've got, you know, nice expressions. Yeah, I just think you get a sense of the two characters from the cover, and the fact that it's a bright, warm story.
And the fact that Bruce Alexander actually looks like the drawing of Arthur on the cover.
So much. I was actually really blown away when I saw Bruce. I was gobsmacked, to be perfectly honest. It was such a shock, because I was like, they literally found the man on the cover in real life.
And I like that Arthur in the book is a fan of audiobooks after he nicked one of Madeline's.
Yes, so Madeline has been encouraging Arthur to sort of do something a little different, and he has given in and is listening, starting to listen to his audiobooks and becoming a bit of a fan, which was something that was such a throwaway little thing for me that was purely based on my dad, because my dad just recently started listening to them, and I was just sort of quite amused at him giving into this technology with his, you know, new Fire tablet, and sort of, you know, getting engaged with this new technology eventually.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
It's something that I've got more into in recent years, because I was such a fan of collecting books and having my bookshelves. But in more recent years, I've definitely got into escaping with the audiobooks, and especially when you're busy and commuting and you're able to sort of, you know, you're not always able to carry one with you. So being able to put your earphones in, whether you're on the tube or on a long train, and being able to sort of have access to these worlds at your fingertips, I think it's just incredible. So yeah, it's definitely become something I love doing much more now.
And is it important your books are available in an alternative format so anyone, regardless of their sight condition, can read?
Absolutely. You know, from a health perspective, I know my great aunt, who's 96, you know, she hasn't had great eyesight now for almost 30 years, and she's able to, you know, to stay in touch with stories like this. And, you know, even my dad, on a health perspective, he's not able to read, you know, actual books. So I love that. But yeah, in general, just the fact that they are available, you know, again, your commuters and your people who are just out and about, and it makes it accessible. And especially for young people as well, who, you know, who might be shy about picking up a book, or, you know, again, I think to myself, you know, at 16, 17, would I have picked up Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out and be nervous of perhaps someone finding it and sort of going, well, why are you reading this? Whereas now, you know, I might be able to listen to it, you know, on my phone, and nobody would know. So in that respect, yeah, I'd love that, you know, people have access to these stories and can hopefully, you know, listen, you know, without health struggles or fear of people knowing what they're doing, just stuff like that. Yeah.
So what sort of literature was available to you when you were coming out?
So my teenage years, I'm trying to think what I was really listening to. I was at a funny stage at that sort of, shall we say, 11 to 18, where I left school to be homeschooled, and I sort of rebelled against reading, and I was struggling with my mental health, and reading was something that suffered at that time for me. And then I was so aware of not perhaps giving myself away. So I sort of shut away these things that I loved doing to make people think that I wasn't doing this, because I was a lover of the library and always wanted to, you know, hang out in there and read books. And that became such a thing that people used against me when I was at school. So it sort of suffered from that. But again, when I was reading, you know, I was at that age where I was going through, you know, the Harry Potter books, my Roald Dahls, you know, things from childhood that I sort of clung on to, you know, his Dark Materials, stuff like that, where I was able to escape into another world, which was what I really craved at that time. So that was really important to me. You know, I'm so jealous now when I look at the incredible books that people of that age now have. You know, there's just so many brilliant authors out there who are writing stories that I wish I'd be able to read, or perhaps not been afraid to read and seek out. You know, when you see the popularity of like Heartstopper or Red, White and Royal Blue, you know, I think it's so wonderful that those books exist now. Things like Tales of the City or Call Me By Your Name, or, you know, even now you've got like They Both Die at the End, or Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda, you know, books like that that exist. It's just brilliant that people can go and pick them. And again, at any age, like I've read them now when I've got, you know, a bit older, and it's just wonderful that those stories are there for people to pick up and lose themselves in, you know. And, you know, or Douglas Stewart, who I think is just sensational, you know, being able to have books like Shuggy Bean or Young Mungo is just incredible. And I think I literally would encourage anyone, you know, of any age to pick them up and read them and sort of lose themselves in those stories.
Now, you mentioned mental health. Is mental health awareness important to you?
Yes, mental health is so important to me. It's been a sort of long struggle that I've had with it since I was 13, 14. You know, I attempted suicides for the first time when I was just about to turn 15. And yeah, it's been a very long, long battle. And, you know, you sort of lose yourself at various points along the way. And, you know, somehow I've been lucky enough to sort of have an incredibly supportive family who've managed to get me back on, you know, the path that I wanted to be on, you know, whenever I've sort of lost that way, and to keep sort of, you know, this sort of dream that I had of writing alive, and encouraged me to do it and supported me through it. So yeah, talking about that, I think, so important, because I never wanted to give up, but at the same time, I did give up along the way. And I think it's important that we remember that even if you do give up, you can find a way back without losing sight of perhaps the dreams and goals you have. You know, I don't regret any of the journey along the way, because I think it's made me who I am and sort of given me that strength to keep going. But yeah, talking about it is not something that I'd ever shy away from, because I think, you know, hearing those stories is so, so important.
Other than reading Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out, what advice would you give to someone who's listening, who's maybe struggling just now?
I think the most important thing is to try and have someone that you can talk to. I think talking is just so important, whether it's, you know, a friend, whether it's family, being able to have that person and not feel like you are completely alone. It was one of the mistakes that I made, and what sort of got me to a breaking point, and hiding it from absolutely everybody. Whereas I think if I had that one person who I really trusted and could confide in and perhaps find the support from, things might have played out slightly differently. But I think it is just knowing that there is hope, and not to get really lost in, firstly, the darkness, but also the fear as well, because it can be completely terrifying. Even when, you know, I look back and think, you know, oh my God, I was so lucky with my family, the fear was still there, purely because it was a total unknown. You know, I was the eldest of five kids, and, you know, nobody had come out in, you know, my extended family that I knew of. So I didn't really know. So it was very much, if I'd perhaps had someone to go, look around, you know these people. You know these people. Your mom is not going to do this. Your dad's not going to do this. And perhaps given me that reassurance and stopped me from creating these worst case scenarios.
Just finally, what do you hope people take away from Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out?
Apart from feeling that warm hug again, I just really hope that there is a sense of hope and encouragement, and the sense that it's never too late to take that chance to be who you are, that no matter what, you deserve it. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're 80, whether you're 20, whether you're 40, 50 in the middle, you deserve the chance to be who you are and to live the life that you really want to live. It's never too late to be you.
don't leave like this. I'm still your dad. Dad! She repeated incredulously. No, you're not. Not anymore. I'd rather you were dead. You're dead to me. Stop it, Lizzie, Patrick said, reaching out to her. She slapped his hand. I mean it. Stay away from me and stay away from my family. Without another word, Elizabeth pulled her jacket off the back of the chair and stormed from the room. Nobody spoke as they heard the front door bang shut, quickly followed by the sound of her car pulling out of the driveway.
The following morning, Teddy had attempted to speak to his mother as they stood alone in the kitchen. Are you going to talk to Grandad today?
I've got nothing to say to him, Edward,
Elizabeth said, carrying on tapping her phone screen.
And I'd rather you had no contact with him either. What? You can't expect... This isn't up for discussion, Edward. You might want to be the man of the house, but while you're under my roof, you will respect my wishes.
Teddy continued making his breakfast. It was too early for a row.
Arthur and Teddy Are Coming Out by Ryan Love is available in print, ebook, and as an audiobook, as read by Bruce Alexander and Caius Nicholas. And thanks to HarperCollins, will be on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library soon. And Ryan will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life. If you're affected by any of the issues we discussed in that interview, Samaritans are available on 116 123 or text SHOUT to 85258. That number again is 116 123.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Before we hear the books of your life from Ryan Love, let's hear from someone who was on the Independent's list of most influential gay people. When he was still director of the British Museum, I was joined down the line by Neil McGregor to talk about his book and radio show Around the World in 100 Objects. And I believe there is a painting I'm very familiar with because it's very local to me that's responsible for your career.
Yes. When I was a child growing up in Glasgow, the great event in the museum and art gallery in Glasgow was the acquisition by Glasgow City of Salvador Dali's Christ on the Cross. We were all taken to see it. It's a very remarkable picture because it's painted as though it's very, very realistic. But in fact, what you're looking at is Christ on the cross floating in the heavens. And I remember as a child being very fascinated by this this contrast between something that looked so real and was so obviously impossible.
Mm.
And then, of course, the wonderful thing about museums in Glasgow and everywhere, because in all our big cities, is that because they're free, and even as a child, youngster, you could go back and back and just slowly get to know them.
Now, as the director of the British Museum, are you trying to acquire pieces that inspire other people as much as that painting inspired you?
Yes, the British Museum tries to acquire a lot because what we're trying to do is really tell the story of humanity from the very beginning to now, and above all, the question of how have different societies organised themselves. So that means, of course, we want to keep collecting contemporary things to look at how society is changing Obviously, in the Middle East at the moment, you'd want to know how that's changed so that we can look back in 100 years and there are the objects, the same in China, India, whatever. So we collect modern things, but we also want to try to collect great things from the past that that will add to the stories we can already tell. So acquiring is quite an important bit.
Now, was it hard to pick just 100 objects?
Oh, it was terrifically difficult, because the museum has millions of objects from all around the world and all through time. So we had to try to choose on the particular set of criteria. And we wanted to start right at the beginning, nearly 2 million years ago, when our ancestors start making tools and start shaping things to use and to look at, and come right up to today. So that was one strand. The 100 objects had to cover 2 million years. But we also wanted to keep going around the world at a given moment, so that if you look at the world 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, look at what's happening in India, in Europe, in America, whatever, so that you can spin the globe at any one point in time and look at what people are doing all around the world.
Now, you touched on this earlier, but it's very important to you that the British Museum, and indeed every museum, should be free.
Yes, that's one of the great traditions about museums in Britain. Parliament set up our museums, beginning with the British Museum, in 1753. And Parliament declared that because these objects were for every citizen, and they were about understanding the world, every citizen should have free access to them. And it's been like that for 250 years now. And every big city, every town, really, in the United Kingdom has great collections from all over the world that are open free. It's one of the things that makes living in Britain different from other countries.
Now, in the history of the world in 100 objects, do you have a favourite?
I do. Well, I've got a couple of favourites, because it's always the way. Am I allowed two favourites?
Of course you are.
the first is a little sculpture, and you can hold it comfortably in your hand. It's about the size of your fist, and it was made about 10,000-12,000 years ago. It was found near Bethlehem. And it's the oldest known representation we have of a couple making love. And it's a pebble that's just been chipped away so that you have a man and a woman embracing each other. And you hold them in your hand as they hold each other. And there's something very, very beautiful about it, these two people that have become one in the stone. And it's the fact that this is the oldest known representation we have of love like that. I find that very moving, very powerful, as well as being very beautiful. And then jumping to about 500 years ago, there's the drawing, the print by Albrecht Dürer of the first rhinoceros to come to Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire. In 1505, an Indian sultan sends a rhinoceros to the king of Portugal, and it causes a great sensation. And it arrives in Lisbon, everybody talks about it. And Dürer, the artist, is living in Nuremberg in South Germany, and he never sees it. But he's heard so much about it that he tries to draw it, and then he makes a print of it. And I think that's a very, very interesting thing, because we all want to have an idea in our heads of things we've heard about but haven't actually experienced. And that's a very human desire. And I find that print of the rhinoceros by a man who'd never seen one, but wanted to see one and heard about it and studied it, that seems to me what a lot of us spend our time doing, trying to make an idea of something we've never actually experienced, but want to understand.
I think my favourite in the 100 objects is it's going to be a lot of people's favourite, is the Rosetta Stone.
Oh, well, the Rosetta Stone is, of course, a real favourite, because what is interesting about the story of things is that, of course, they go on doing unexpected tasks long after they've been made and long after the people that have made them have died. So the Rosetta Stone was really a way of publishing a legal agreement between the king of Egypt and the priests, that if the priests supported the king, he would give the temples a tax break. So it's really a kind of budget statement, and it's just as boring. But of course, it was written in three languages. And long after the priests and the king were dead, when it was discovered around 1800 in Egypt, it became, of course, as everybody knows, the basis on which we were at last able to read the hieroglyphics. But I love the fact that that's, of course, not at all what it was made for, and that the people who carved it, everybody involved with it when it was made, would be astonished to think that we were still interested in it and that it had done this totally, totally unexpected thing.
It was. I remember seeing it as a small boy, and not for what it says, but for what it allowed people to do. Just
exactly.
It's an incredible object. It's something I always go out my way to see, actually, when I'm...
Well, exactly. I remember when I was first brought from Scotland to London, when I was eight, I was brought to see it. And in those days, you were allowed to touch it. And I so remember that excitement of touching the object. And in fact, because now we can't, the original has to be protected in the case, we've made a copy so that it's still possible to touch it. And you can still run your fingers over the inscriptions and feel the Greek letters, which everybody could read and understand, and the Egyptian hieroglyphics, which they were able to discover. Because that chance to touch is such an important thing.
That's a point, actually. We are on RNIB's radio, and many of the objects at the British Museum are behind glass. So what facilities are at the museum for people with no sight?
Well, we've tried to do quite a number of things. As I say, there's the replica of the Rosetta Stone. There's also a replica of some of the Parthenon sculptures, so that people can experience that by touch. But we have, for all our exhibitions and for a number of our galleries, we've got Braille books and large print books. So that the information about the objects is available. And we run regular, for everybody, all members of the public, we have objects that are out in the galleries to be handled, because quite a lot of the objects in the museum are actually very tough, and you only put them in a case to stop people walking away with them. There's no reason why they shouldn't be handled. So in a number of galleries, we've got desks, and the volunteers help us do this, where visitors can come and touch the objects and feel them, hold them, feel the weight, how they fit into their hand, how they're made. And we have that for all the public all the time. But we also have special handling sessions for blind and partially sighted visitors. At regular moments as well. So we try to allow as much touch as possible.
Accessible to everyone and free of charge.
Exactly.
A History of the World in 100 Objects is available from RNIB Talking Books. And of course, the print version is available wherever books are sold. Neil McGregor, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support, whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, "Alexa, call RNIB helpline" for more information. RNIB. See differently.
And now a return to author Ryan Love for the books of his life. Ryan, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with the reading?
I would have to say it was Roald Dahl's Matilda. The first time I read it, I just remember falling in love completely, and it showed me this character who loved books and could escape to the library and had the freedom to escape this world she didn't feel part of, and she could escape and, you know, just become absorbed in these incredible stories. And it sort of showed me and encouraged me to sort of go and do the same thing. I just loved that so much. I became completely obsessed with it. And it was just such an important book for me at that point, where I was like, wow, books exist and books are incredible. And I want to read, but I also want to write and sort of have that, create something that is something that someone will want to pick up and escape into.
Matilda sat down again at her desk. The Trunchbull seated herself behind the teacher's table. It was the first time she'd sat down during the lesson. Then she reached out a hand and took hold of a water jug. Still holding the jug by the handle, but not lifting it yet, she said, "I have never been able to understand why small children are so disgusting. They are the bane of my life. They are like insects. They should be got rid of as early as possible. We get rid of flies with flypaper, and by hanging up flypaper. I've often thought of inventing a spray for get rid of small children. How splendid it would be to walk into this classroom with a gigantic spray gun in my hands and start pumping it. Or better still, some huge strips of sticky paper. I would hang them all around the school, and you'd all get stuck to them, and that would be the end to it. Wouldn't that be a good idea, Miss Honey?"
"If it's meant to be a joke, Headmistress, I don't think it's a very funny one," Miss Honey said from the back of the class.
"Well, you wouldn't, would you, Miss Honey?" the Trunchbull said. "And it's not meant to be a joke. My idea of a perfect school, Miss Honey, is one that has no children in it at all. And one of these days, I shall start up a school like that. I think it shall be very successful."
"The woman's mad," Miss Honey was telling herself. "She's round the twist. She's the one who ought to be got rid of." The Trunchbull now lifted the large blue porcelain water jug and poured some water into her glass. And suddenly, with the water, came out the long, slimy newt, straight into the glass. Plop. The Trunchbull let out a yell and leapt off a chair, as though a firecracker had gone off underneath her. And now the children also saw the long, thin, slimy, yellow-bellied, lizard-like creature twisting and turning in the glass, and they squirmed and jumped about as well, shouting,
"Oh, what is it? Oh, it's disgusting. It's a snake. It's a baby crocodile. It's an alligator."
"Look out, Miss Trunchbull," said Lavender. "I'll bet it bites."
The Trunchbull, this mighty female giant, stood there in her green breeches, quivering like a blancmange. She was especially furious that someone had succeeded in making her jump and yell like that, because she prided herself on her toughness.
That's Jean Ford, reading from Matilda by Roald Dahl, one of many Roald Dahl books available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, including James and the Giant Peach, which was narrated by Roald Dahl himself.
James and the Giant Peach was the very first of the 15 or 16 children's books I have written. I wrote it in 1961 in America, some 26 years ago. And up to then, I'd spent a long time, about 15 years, writing only short stories for adults. But by then, I had a couple of children of my own, and I used to tell them stories in bed, and one day I told them one that they seemed to like and wanted more of, and it was about a peach. And so I thought, well, why don't I try to write a children's book about it? And so I did. Here is James Henry Trotter when he was about 4 years old. Then there's a picture of a very happy little boy.
Now, is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
There's a few. I guess, again, Matilda is one of those books that sort of sits on my shelf, but there's also Charlotte's Web, which I absolutely adore, and it sort of takes me back to that sort of time in my life and mom reading it to me and then me being able to pick it up myself. I absolutely adore that story. The Secret Garden was another one that I fell in love with as a child and again has sort of stayed with me throughout different stages of my life. In more recent years, Matt Haig's Reasons to Stay Alive has become one of the most important to me, because I think it was such an important book at the stage of life I was in to read and sort of remind myself that things do get better, you know, just where I was at that time. It wasn't a great period, but this book sort of fell into my lap and I sort of saw it as being a sign to me, you know, and sort of, you know, when those sort of books come along when you least expect it and it just sort of hits you perfectly, you know, and you're like, wow, this was just meant to get me at this time.
11 years after smashing a window in my sleep, during those breakdown months, as I'd later call them, there was a lot of empty time to stare worry in the face. My parents would get up and leave for work, and then me and Andrea would have long days in the house. It's weird to write about this period. I mean, really, there's nothing to write about. It was, from the outside, the least eventful phase of my life by quite a way. From the outside, it was me talking with Andrea, either in my childhood bedroom or downstairs in the kitchen. Occasionally, we'd venture outside for a short walk in the afternoon. We would go either to the nearest corner shop, only about 200 or 300 metres away, or, on more adventurous days, we would go and walk by the River Trent, which was a little further away, on the other side of a town centre, and involved me walking through streets I knew so well from childhood. How could they stay the same when I felt so different? Sometimes, we bought a newspaper and a tin of soup and some bread, and we would return and read a bit of the paper and make the soup. Later, we might help prepare the evening meal. And that was about it. Talking and sitting and walking. Hardly Lawrence of Arabia. Life at the lowest possible volume 2 24-year-olds could manage. And yet those days were the most intense I have lived. Those days contained thousands of tiny battles. They are filled with memories so painful I can only now, with the distance of 14 and a half years, look at them head on. I was a nervous wreck. People say, take it one day at a time. But, I used to think to myself, that's all right for them to say. Days were mountains. A week was a trek across the Himalayas. You see, people say that time is relative, but it really is.
That's Matt Haig himself reading his book Reasons to Stay Alive, one of many Matt Haig books available from RNIB Talking Books. Also available are The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett as read by John Curl, and Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, narrated by Liza Ross. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yes, so it would have to be Matt Cain's Becoming Ted. It's such a gorgeous book of love, friendship, just, again, being true to yourself. And I think it's just such a wonderfully positive book. But again, it's about acceptance, but doesn't shy away from telling you about the hard times and the struggles that the characters have been. There's such wonderful friendships between, you know, the lead character and, you know, the other characters. You know, so you've got like Teddy Ainsworth, who's the main character, and then you've got his friend Denise, and there's such incredible relationships that Matt writes so beautifully. And you learn about the experiences perhaps of being gay in the 1950s. And again, it's just those sort of stories that I just love being told and learning about, and, you know, just really sort of losing yourself with warm characters who can educate you but at the same time really make you feel hopeful. So yeah, absolutely. I think Becoming Ted is one of those beautiful books that I really hope people get a chance to pick up.
There isn't anything remotely remarkable about Ted.
He's 43 years old, of average height, with a smattering of freckles on his cheeks and a physique that could best be described as a dad bod, if the dad in question broke out in hives at the sight of an exercise bike and every lunchtime was gripped by an irresistible craving for a meat and potato pasty. He has pale grey eyes and hair his mum often says is the colour of a perfect batch of coffee ice cream. Except Ted knows from experience that nobody likes coffee ice cream, not even people who like coffee. Besides, that flavour comes out a dull, weak brown, while Giles's hair is the rich, luxurious brown of chocolate, Ainsworth's most popular flavour. It's set off by his equally rich brown eyes and two little moles on his left cheekbone. Not unsightly, unsexy freckles like Ted's, more like those delicious little chocolate drops people love to sprinkle on their ice cream. God, I'm so lucky. So lucky. So chuffed. And so grateful. Ted wants to snuggle up to his husband, but stretched out between them is their dog, Lily. A brown and black short-haired terrier crossbreed, Lily is usually desperate to be taken for a walk first thing in the morning, but today seems happy to snooze. Ted knows he'll have to take her out soon, but doesn't want to disturb her, especially when she slides under the crook of Giles's arm. Without opening his eyes, Giles pulls her in closer, and their breathing slowly falls into sync. Ted's heart gives another wobble. He finishes his coffee and puts his cup on the side, as quietly as he can so he doesn't wake them. It'll be a shame if Giles's coffee goes cold, but he can always go back downstairs and make him a fresh pot. This isn't something he'd admit to his colleagues at work, women who often moan about their inattentive men, many of whom expect to be waited on. But Ted actually likes waiting on Giles. How could I not, when he looks like this?
Becoming Ted by Matt Cane is read by Samuel Barnett and is available commercially. And once again, Ryan Love, thank you so much. That's it for this week, but if you can't wait until we're back at the same time next week, there are over 300 episodes of Read On available in your favourite podcast app. Just search for Read On RNIB. If you have any questions about the show, you can either email radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on Twitter. I'm @talking_books.